Dr. Melvin Morse has researched near-death experiences in children and adults now for more than 15 years. His interest evolved from the experiences working in critical care medicine at Seattle's Children's Hospital. We'll have him talk with you more about that. And he's also done some incredible work in controlled remote viewing, which we'll talk about next hour here on Coast to Coast. Dr. Melvin Morse. Melvin, how are you, sir?
I am so fine, and I'm glad to be on your show again. It's such a pleasure.
My God, and you were on almost 5 years ago, weren't you?
That's right.
My gosh. So in between these 5 years, you've been studying near-death experiences, of course, with children. You've been doing some work in remote viewing. Let's go back a little bit, Melvin. Tell us how you got involved in this study of children's near-death experiences.
You know, I just happened to fall into it. I was working at the Seattle Children's Hospital and working primarily in critical care medicine, working for Airlift Northwest, transporting critically ill children from the, you know, Alaska, Montana, children that, you know, fell into septic tanks or were in swimming pools for, you know, for 45 minutes underwater and resuscitating these patients. And I just happened to resuscitate a young girl out in Pocatello, Idaho, who she was underwater for 18 minutes documented. So we don't think of that as compatible with life. And yet she certainly was resuscitated, and not only was she resuscitated, but she went on to give me a blow-by-blow description of her own resuscitation. And, you know, George, not something that she just invented from seeing, you know, TV.
Right.
She, you know, little comments that the nurses made about one of their cats that had died. She accurately described my putting a tube in her nose, then threading it down into her lungs, to put her on the mechanical ventilation. The sequence of events, you know, boy, you had me in this one room, then you took me to another room that looked like a big donut, which was her description of a CAT scanner. And I just, you know, and then she went on to tell her spiritual journey. But to tell you the truth, at the time I'd been accepted for a neurology fellowship down at the University of California in San Francisco, and I was mostly blown away by her accurate and detailed
description.
Yeah, I mean, of her own resuscitation, because, we're not supposed to have any memories. We're not supposed to be having any kind of memories of a time that we're dying and unconscious. And I think it's fair to say that her brain was dead, that her pupils were fixed and dilated. She didn't have any kind of protective reflexes, anything like that. So as a budding neurologist-to-be and internal, critical care medicine, I was mostly interested in what did this mean about memory? Because we think of course, memories as being stored in the brain, and yet she obviously, quite obviously, was remembering things with a completely non-functional brain.
Was she, or did she ever say she saw this? Or was it something that she felt like she heard or remembered?
They see it as vividly as this reality that we're seeing right now.
Okay.
Another child, not her, said to me, he says, "It was real, Dr. Morse. It was realer than real." But I have to say, what she told me, she goes, "I wasn't dead. I wasn't dead at all. I was alive." I mean, and just wonder in her voice. And I have to tell you, I feel one of the most fortunate persons on earth because, I would never have really believed this if I didn't see it for myself. It so flies in the face of, you know, at that time, the gods that I worshipped were, you know, Plum and Posner, who wrote The Diagnosis of Stupor and Coma.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Johns Hopkins. I mean, we didn't, we're taught that coma wipes clean the slate of consciousness. There's no medical model for how a dying or dead brain can retain consciousness. And so as a result, as a physician, you know, people always say, well, you know, gosh, you know, my doctor didn't believe me, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course we didn't, because it's not, you know, we don't have a frame of reference to put it in. If I hadn't seen it for myself, I would have just assumed, oh, maybe she wasn't really unconscious. We all know that sometimes these patients sort of wax and wane in their level of consciousness. Maybe, like you said, you know, she sort of hears some things, and maybe she gains consciousness, mm-hmm. makes, you know, and then sort of confabulates and creates, this sort of fantasy. But having resuscitated the patient myself, she told me at one point, she said, I was floating over you and I saw you go to the phone and talk to another doctor and say, what am I supposed to do now? Which was exactly accurate.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to decide whether we should just, you know, pull the plug, or whether we should transport her down to Primary Children's Hospital down in Salt Lake City in Idaho. And, in emergency medicine, we say that you're not dead unless you're warm and dead. And so, the attendings and, you know, supervising guys up in Seattle said, well, let's give her a few more minutes, see if, deciding that she's not going to come back. But she was underwater for 18 minutes, and then her resuscitation took well over 45 minutes
before
we finally got heartbeat back.
You must have been in shock when all that started to function again.
Yeah, well, there's that aspect of it. You know, just...
Why did you keep at it, by the way, Doctor?
We just do. You know, they say that these resuscitations go on until the last person is sick of it. You know, quite frankly, most resuscitations in children, it has a bad outcome, and we're just kind of used to just sort of flailing away until the patient dies. I think it's probably because it's a child.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that motivates everybody a little bit more. And I think also there's a sense of, you know, this might sound like a weird thing to say, but it's absolutely true that from a parent's perspective, you want to know that the doctors did everything. And you just really, you know, when, you know, so, you know, since 99 out of 100 patients that I attempted to resuscitate, you know, in fact, went on to die or be in a vegetative state, when you're going to talk to those parents, you want to look them in the eye and say, I did everything. And sure enough, you know, so that's I think, why we go on and on. It certainly wasn't for, you know, any thinking that, you know, that it was going to be successful. The parents thought it would be successful. They had sort of a prayer circle around the child and, you know, asked if that was okay. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this child's never going to live, so, you know, they might as well, you know, just like I'm going to do everything so I can feel good, that they're going to try to do everything so they can feel good.
Based on what you have been able to put together about this particular case and what she witnessed and how she witnessed it, God forbid, but she, you know, had she died, what do you think would have happened? Making the assumption that this near-death experience was real and that she was floating above her body, she was witnessing things, but had she died during some point, what do you think would have happened thereafter?
Well, you know, they're not after death experiences, but I mean, all of them, you know, I've patients I've resuscitated myself, you know, probably 40 or 50 of them, and then the cases I've studied, they describe that then they go into a loving light, a light that tells them that we're here on earth to learn lessons of love. So we learn things when we die. So, I mean, I'm emphasizing that because that's one part about it that I don't often hear people say, you know, that because you've asked a really good question. Well, you know, what happens, in other words, you know, after we die? Well, I can tell you right now, the first thing is that we learn things. And so, you know, so whether we studied near-death experiences in Japan, we studied them in Africa. There's been people who have studied them in Micronesia, and the circumstances are all different. And yet, that sense of learning when we die is one universal constant. So that, to me, strongly implies that there must be some sort of life after death.
Yes.
And quite frankly, is one of the, to me, biggest pieces of circumstantial evidence that, you know, there must be more lives. Because after all, I mean, why would we learn stuff when we die? If this is just some sort of great fireworks, you know, I've often heard, and quite frankly, I'm sympathetic to the concept that this is all just some wonderful fireworks when we die. You know, this is like a beautiful way to ease us into death. Well, but why then why spend all that brain power and energy teaching? You know, so what we learn is very specific. We learn lessons of love about our own lives. We never learn that, you know, that we didn't spend enough time making money or, you know, getting to work on time.
What do you think is the trigger that released that, let's say, astral body that was in the hospital room? And maybe it was, you know, floating over her body while it was dead, you know, when an ambulance was taking her in or something. Who knows? But what do you think the trigger was to release that astral body, to get it out of the body?
That's a really great question. I think that we know that now. You know, I think that we know enough about the science and the neurobiology, you know, the brain science of the near-death experience, that there is a specific area in the brain that when it's triggered, that's when in turn we trigger the out-of-body experience. So it's looking at her experience, just going through it in detail, the first thing that happened to her was a sense of everything being all blank or all dark. And so that corresponds to the lack of input from our ordinary senses. And that's the same process, for example, that meditators go through. You know, there's a specific area in the brain that when they meditate actually turns off to dampen down or even stop all sensory input. And then once all that sensory input is gone, then there's a lot of increased activity in the right temporal lobe. And there's a specific area in the right temporal lobe that triggers that sense of being out of the body. And then when does that happen? Well, I think that happens differently for each person who's dying. I think there's some people who, you know, every physician who's listening to this knows there's many patients who they've died long before that, you know, they show any signs of physical death. You know, you just sort of see, you know, their eyes just go blank. I remember when I was a medical student, there was this man, he told the surgeon flat out, he said, I want to die. I don't want you to operate on me. And they did anyway. And he looked at the surgeon and he just said, you know, SOB, you did it anyway. And he turned his face to the wall and never talked again. And you know, I'm sure at that moment for him, he triggered that out of body, because he lived on for many weeks and then finally died, you know, just sort of an empty shell. Whereas I think for other people, you know, it's right at the point of death. But still, you know, regardless, it's still a trigger within the brain. I love the way you said that. I think it's a specific trigger that's within our brain. And that's the same trigger that people are, you know, this is how I got involved in remote viewing and such. It's the same trigger that people trigger to remote view or to do meditation or, you know, other types of out-of-body experiences.
This is remarkable. We're with Dr. Melvin Morse's latest work, Where God Lives. Have you been able to follow some of the children as they got a little older after these experiences?
Oh, man. We studied not only because I've been doing this for so long. Another amazing thing that happened to me was, I resuscitating critically ill children is a young man's game. And so I started doing that when I was about 30 years old. So, you know, now I'm 54. And so I've been doing this for 25 years.
Sure, that's a long time, Melvin.
So we've been able to study our original children now as adults, We used to have them over to my place in Tacoma, Washington, for a picnic every year. We've been able to study them, and then we also studied well over 100 adults who had near-death experiences as children. Many of them didn't know they had a near-death experience. I got to tell you, here's a typical kind of patient that we would recruited, because we didn't want people who, you know, sort of had that, oh, I know I've had a near-death experience, I'm in the New Age religion and blah, blah, blah. I was talking to this young man about having his tonsils out, and his grandfather's there, and he goes, tell him about the tunnel. and then his daughter's trying to shush him, and he's, oh, he's always talking about these weird things. And the grandfather says to me, no, tell him about the tunnel. That's what happens when you have your tonsils out. And it turns out that when we got his medical records, he'd had a cardiac arrest when his tonsils were out.
Oh, my
God. And he thought this was just some weird side effect. So he said that he went through a tunnel and that wrapped into a giant shell and then put him out on a beach where there was a sun, and that the sun, all his family and everything that was good and God was in that sun. So, typical near-death experience.
Are these children who become adults after these experiences, are they a little more enlightened? Are they more tuned in psychically?
Well, you know, when I give lectures on this, I got to tell you that I have a slide, and it has in giant letters, the big secret of life revealed from children who've been to beyond the grave. Yeah. Because listen to this. I mean, you know, you got to really listen up to this. This speaks so much about how we should live our lives. When we looked at these, you know, adults, you know, had near-death experiences as children, adults in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, we did every kind of psychological test you can imagine. They showed us their tax returns, you know, their occupations, death anxiety scores, you know, every kind of thing you can imagine that university psychiatrists, you know, would dream up to test somebody. And basically, what we learned is that they're really nice people.
Yep.
So, you know, and I love that about it. They didn't learn some deep esoteric truth. They're not like little mini Buddhas running around, you know. They're not. They're people who give more money to charity than our control groups. They take fewer over-the-counter medications than our control groups. They ate more fresh fruits and vegetables. They exercised more regularly. They spent more time in helping professions and volunteer activities. They spent more time with their families. But you know, see, you don't have to die to learn that kind of stuff. We all know that's what we're supposed to be doing. Nobody seriously thinks that the secret of life is to make more money than everybody else. But we just sort of get caught up in it. Whereas, you know, when you've had a near-death experience, you know, I call it the post-traumatic bliss syndrome. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you have a post-traumatic stress syndrome and, you know, you're sort of reliving the trauma, you know, of your experience. You know, if you were in Vietnam or, you know, had some, you know, childhood trauma or something. Well, they've had the opposite. You know, they're constantly reliving that concept of being in the light. And this one girl, she told me, she said, I said, what'd you learn from it all? She said, I see pieces of that light in everything I do and everything I see. So I said, well, what's that mean to you? Well, I don't mind waiting in line at the supermarket. You know, because when she's there, you know, she's like in the moment. She's in the now. She's not like me, you know, just sitting there impatiently wanting to get to the line, you know, et cetera. And she's, you know, I mean, that's a really important lesson, that it's not something dramatic or, you know, it's something we can all access.
This is fascinating. Dr. Melvin Morris, our special guest tonight, his latest work, Where Gods Live. And we'll be back in a moment. We'll continue talking about the near-death study of children. Next hour, controlled remote viewing. We're with Dr. Melvin Morris. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Melvin, with your study of near-death experiences, did other groups or study researchers pick up on some of your work and run with it?
George, I've got to brag to you and tell you that's the case.
accent.
But I'm going to put it in perspective because, you know, nobody does anything by themselves. But the first researchers was a generation of Raymond Moody and Michael Sabam. And what they did was, you know, basically they studied adults who would approach them and say, I had a near-death experience. So, you know, that's what we call a retrospective study, you know, meaning that, you know, here's a group of people that say something unusual happened to me, and then, you know, they tried to piece together what happened to them by looking at their medical records, et cetera. Well, our groups, you know, what we did was we did what's called a prospective study, meaning we moved forward in time. We interviewed every survivor of cardiac arrest, every child in the Seattle Children's Hospital intensive care unit that survived a cardiac arrest over about a 15-year period. So that means, we were able to capture, you know, everybody, you know, not so, you know, the criticism of the other studies was, well, you know, what about all the people that didn't have near-death experiences and, you know, they don't want to talk about it, or what about all the people that had, you know, the different types of experiences, yeah, et cetera. So we were able to interview every single child as we move forward, and we found, we were able to answer a lot of the questions that people have. Are these experiences caused by a lack of oxygen in the brain? Are these experiences caused by medications? Because we could have control subjects who had a lack of oxygen in their brain, or they were treated with medications, but they were not near death. We were able to compare them with our children who survived cardiac arrest. And we were able to show that you have to come to the point of death to have this near-death experience, as opposed to it being caused by, you know, starvation of oxygen or different drugs, etc. So, and then, you know, one study doesn't do it. So a guy named Pin von Lummel, actually I met with him in about 1995, and he and I worked together to try to have a very similar research design, you know, our research design in children, and then he did a very similar research design in adults, the same kind of a study where they just interviewed, you know, all comers. I think it was in about 8 hospitals in the Netherlands, and we published our study in the American Medical Association's pediatric journals, and Pin von Lummel published his study in The Lancet, which is arguably one of the world's most prestigious journals.
Oh, absolutely. Did mainstream pick it up at all, your study?
Oh, absolutely. Right. Good. Now, so when our study, then Pin von Lummel's study, and now the United Nations is doing something called the AWARE study, which is 25 centers around the world who
Fantastic.
Are all collaborating to study near-death experiences. So when people tell me that science is against spirituality, or that, you know, there's some sort of conspiracy of, you know, of scientists to, you know, to suppress this kind of information, it's not that at all. It's just this sort of thing, it flies in the face of our paradigm. We don't have a way of understanding it, but if you do well-designed research on spiritual topics, you will get published. And we had no trouble getting published, even though when we first published, we weren't really able to explain it. We were just able to say, hey, you know, this is a phenomena. You know, patients whose brains apparently die, you know, when they're resuscitated, they tell us what it was like. So, there's, when people say to me, well, you know, have we proved whether there's life after death? Well, we've certainly proved that consciousness persists at the point of death. I don't even know why that's controversial anymore, George.
But it is.
Well, but
not on this show, but it is.
Right. But they're not reading the literature. I mean, really. I mean, they're just sticking their heads in the sand and they're going, you know, it can't be that. But there's over 12 mainstream excellent physician researchers who are publishing in mainstream journals. Bruce Grayson, the guy, I've forgotten the name of the guy that's doing the United Nations study, you know, et cetera. And all of them agree that consciousness persists at the point of death. I mean, meaning like these kids tell me, I was alive. I like to hear it from kids, actually. You know, one child told me, I said, what was it like for you? And he said it was really scary. And I said, why? And he said, because I didn't know how I was going to get back in my body. I mean, that's how real this experience is. The experience is just as real as what's going on around us. Now George, I got to just tell you something from the last break, because this is so important. We spend all our time, and I know, you know, I listen to your show all the time. You know, we're always interested in astral travel and leaving our bodies, and, you know, we're interested in the paranormal, etc. But children who've had near-death experiences, when they grow up, they want to live this reality. They want to anchor the light in this reality.
That's true.
And I got to tell you a quick story. Part of our study of the long-term follow-up of these patients was, I asked this guy, what does near-death experience mean to him? And he said, well, you know, I was told, I know how important my life is, because I was told, go back, Bobby, you have a job to do. So I was a lot younger then, and I was hearing this, and I'm like, oh, great, he, you know, it was a cure for cancer, or, you know, I don't, you know, he's going to set up his own church, or, you know, come on, all right, you know, I'll bite, you know, tell me, what is your job? And he looks at me, and he's angry, and he goes, I told you what my job is. I run a construction company, and those numbnuts couldn't get along without me if I wasn't running the show. And you know, so he was sent back from his near-death experience by this God that we'd all love to encounter to run a small construction company in our rural Washington state. but wait a minute, doesn't that tell us something about the importance of our lives then?
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
does.
All of us need to start feeling that.
Did your work in this study change your perception of what's on the other side?
Absolutely. Because I'll just tell you right now, because my bias is, it's not on the other side. It's here, the time. It's with us all the time. If there's one thing I could tell you that I've learned is that, we've been through this time, I think maybe the last 100 years, where we talk about the metaphysical movement. So the metaphysical movement, of course, is that spiritual matters are not part of this physical reality. But near-death research tells us that it is part of this reality. That, you know, that if you look, you know, why not just cut to the chase? If anybody listening to this show, just if you pay attention to your life and see what's going on around you, you will see, you know, what people call angels. You will see miracles happening every single day as part of this reality. So it's not the other side. It's this side.
And the secret is, I mean, here you're 54, I'm 58, yeah. I'm going to be 59 in a couple weeks. I don't want to check out early. You don't want to check out early. But we can use these things that are experiences and make this life even better.
Absolutely.
No doubt about it. Was that Dr. Sam Parnia?
Sam Parnia.
Was that him?
That runs the AWARE study. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, near-death research is so solid now that we now have 3 generations of researchers who all publish in mainstream medical and scientific journals and all have basically reached the same conclusions. You know, we have, you know, and he's part of, I think, the Sam Parnia and his group, Kit Green, there's a number of them, are part of now another generation of researchers. And I think that any discussion of this has to start with the bedrock truth that we're still alive when we die. And then that's the challenge to neuroscience. How can that be? I sure didn't learn that in medical school. You know, I always thought when you died, you died.
Yeah.
And that is clearly not the case.
Is it all tied to brain function, or is there something else out there? Consciousness, something in the universe beyond what we truly understand yet.
Okay. Here's the deal. You know, we'll just skip right to the end. Why not? Here's what I've learned after studying this for 25 years. The materialistic worldview that I was taught, and, you know, you were probably taught, and we're all, You know, is it, you know, first there was, you know, atoms, and then those atoms combined to make organisms, and then those organisms evolved and evolved and evolved, and you know, finally you had human beings, and then somehow consciousness evolved. But there's a different way of looking at life, and they call it top-down causation. And virtually every neuroscientist who's doing any kind of cutting-edge research looks at reality differently, that it's consciousness that comes first. And then the brain is sort of the interpreter of consciousness for this reality. And then you go from large structures like the brain to smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until you finally get down to atoms and subatomic particles. And if you look at reality from that standpoint, which is, it, you know, it's kind of a, but that's the way the theoretical physicists, I mean, theoretical physicists have absolutely no trouble with what I'm just saying. You know, they believe that all of reality is this sort of non-local, no space, no time. But the concepts of time and space are really just because of us as biological machines. But, you know, so really, modern science works best if you think of consciousness first and everything springing from that. You really can't explain it any other way.
I've got to tell you, you are one of the most enlightened people that we've talked to on this program when it has to do with this kind of experience. Because, I mean, number one, you're from the medical field. You bring a perspective that not a lot of people understand, Doctor. And you make it so darn fascinating that I think you also give people hope.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that because, you know, so now let me, you know, answer your question directly. You're saying, is this all in the brain? Well, see, this is the great divider. Is I'm going to say yes, it's all in the brain, George. But that's because everything is in the brain.
Explain
this conversation
that, because
is in the brain. When we look, when you look and see something, you know, with your eyes, whatever, you know, people are, you know, looking at their, you know, computer screen, or that's, your eyes aren't video cameras. You're actually creating that reality, and our brains only take 1% of the information that we receive, 1% of that is used to create this sense of consciousness and, you know, our visual and auditory perception of reality. So if you understand that, then, you know, then you can see, well, everything's in our brain. And so the fact that about 20-25% of our brain is dedicated to having spiritual experiences, for, you know, as a, you know, medical scientist, that makes them more real to me. I don't understand people that, you know, on hearing that 25% of the brain is dedicated to, you know, having a spiritual experience, then say, aha, see, that's just in the brain. Well, you know, about 20% of our brain is dedicated to have visual experiences, but I don't hear anybody going, aha, you know, that apple you just ate was just in your brain. But it was.
It doesn't taste good. When you die, physically die, and the brain decomposes, becomes dust, something is still happening. We're in the afterlife. It's functioning. It's working. That release, have you been able to put that together yet?
Sure.
That transition.
You know, I think there's a number of different ways to put it together, but they're all new. Okay, going back to what I was saying, you know, that consciousness comes first, and then we have a brain to express that consciousness, you know, to sense and to learn lessons from this reality. Well, for the first time, then, reincarnation makes sense to me. I never understood how reincarnation could work. Otherwise, I mean, if you're, you know, if we're just a body and then we die, well, then how does anything from our body get to, you know, the new reincarnated body?
Right, right.
But if we're a conscious entity first, well, then we're just sort of going through brain after brain after brain after brain, and we're expressing ourselves, you know, and sampling this reality, you know, through different you know, through different brains, basically. Now, how does that actually happen? Well, you know, the quantum, you know, quantum physicists would argue that there's this sort of infinite sea of possibility. And then when we actually think a thought, or we as conscious beings focus our attention, that then everything, you know, all these different possibilities then collapse into one possibility. You know, that's a, you know, so, I mean, to you know, so for example, the chair that I'm sitting on, you know, there's actually, you know, an infinite number of possible chairs, and they've actually been able to measure this in the laboratory, you know, all different sizes. But of course, the sizes are, you know, shift, you know, to 10 to the minus, you know, 14th or whatever, you know, well below our level of perception. But nevertheless, you know, there's all these different chairs, and they're all different sizes. But the probability is that when we look at that chair, it's not going to, you know, move more than 10 to the minus 17th. It's, to us, still going to seem like a chair. So, you know, there's a 99.9%, you know, possibility that that chair will be there every time we look at it. But that when we look away from it, it dissolves into this endless possibility. Well, that's a very simple example, but it comes right to the point of questions like, you know, do angels exist? Well, you know, there certainly is enough information in the universe for angels to exist. There's certainly enough unexplained matter and unexplained energy for angels to exist. But if we don't open our mind to that endless sense of possibility, we're never going to see them.
I guess that could, go ahead.
Well, we know that's true because of studies where they take people and they dress them up in gorilla suits and they have them walk, you know, through small, you know, passageways or small corridors with, you know, students, you know, playing basketball and such. And then afterwards, they'll ask the students, they'll say, well, did you see that guy in the gorilla suit? And they'll say no, because they you know, so this isn't some, you know, new age, you know, retelling of, you know, Columbus coming to America that nobody really knows if that, you know, is true or not, that, you know, that the first Americans didn't see those ships coming across the horizon. I mean, these are studies of perception done today that show that if a guy in a gorilla suit walks by us, 50% of us won't see it. So if that's the case, well, then we're not seeing angels. We're not seeing, you know, all kinds of things in our realities. You know, so anyway, so that's one way to look at it, this concept of infinite possibilities. Then, you know, I'll just tell you real quick, there's another guy. His name is Terence Witt, and he wrote a book called Our Undiscovered Universe, and he argues very strongly that there's no infinite possibilities of reality. There's just one reality that's all interconnected, that, you know, that really, that we're all, you know, that you know, when I move my arm, you know, the whole, all of reality is subtly altered by that. And that, you know, within that paradigm, that, you know, us as conscious beings, you know, that's the sort of the primary mover of the universe, and everything else springs from that, without this sense of, you know, endless possibilities. So, but, you know, one way or another, though, there's obviously is consciousness first, and then we as biological beings second.
Stay with us. This is just incredible work on your behalf. Dr. Melvin Morse, next up, we're talking about controlled remote viewing right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Morse, tell me now, what does it mean by controlled remote viewing?
Okay, controlled remote viewing. All right, remote viewing is just when we can see something at a distance that we shouldn't be able to see with our ordinary senses.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's had, you know, a little bit of that. You know, a lot of it are, you know, spontaneous kinds of things. I don't know, I was at the baseball game once, and I just had this vivid premonition and this sense that my daughter was in a car accident. And I sort of had a brief sort of visual image of it. And, you know, I jumped up, and sure enough, she had been in a car accident. Okay, that's not what we're talking about, George. Okay, controlled remote viewing is exactly that, when you're in control of the process. So it gets rid of this phenomena where, you know, like, you know, I went to the racetrack once with my daughter, and she just sort of blurts out, "Oh, I think that horse is going to win." Well, I knew that horse was a mortal lock. You know, really, there was like 5 minutes to post time. I ran to the gate, and I, every dime I had, you know, I put on that horse to win.
What did it pay? What were the odds?
I don't remember, but it was, it was 10, 12 to 1 or something like that. But the point is that she didn't know that she couldn't do it. You know, she just was like, because then after, you know, after we're all celebrating and everything, then the second time she's like, "Oh, I think this one's going to win." Well, that one didn't win. You know, I mean, you know, and we saw this phenomena with the parapsychological research, where they would have these people that, you know, they would sort of, you know, try to intuit, you know, what is a card that's being played, and they'd notice that in the first start of the study that people, in fact, were able to do it. And then, you know, as the studies went further and, you know, skeptics, you know, tried to test it, et cetera, then mysteriously the phenomena would disappear. Well, we know why that happened now. Because we know that these psychical abilities are right brain events. And when we can do them, then we like go, "Oh my God." So the first time out of the box, we didn't know we couldn't do it. So it just happened. Well, then afterwards, now we have a lot of mental noise. Oh, can I really do it? Does this really exist? Do psychical abilities really happen? Yeah. And then they try to do all this sort of, you know, validation and verification. Or, you know, I mean, you know, people who are mediums, you know, get into that, you know, first, you know, before they can, you know, start to, you know, connect you with, you know, your mother or, you know, whatever, who is your child who's died. First they have to, you know, they have to try to, you know, tell you some things about your life that then you're going to go, "Aha, see, she's the real deal. You know, she can really channel these perceptions." Mm-hmm. And there's all that kind of left brain noise, you know, that analytic noise, and then that keeps you from being able to do it. So, you know, this is what I've just described to you is 50 years of parapsychological research. That's why, you know, these people have all these results, and then the skeptics come along, and well, now the left brain has, you know, a lot of analysis. Can I do it? Are these, you know, and you know all these debates,
sure.
And it just interferes with it. Well, controlled remote viewing, first of all, we don't have to wonder whether there really is, you know, a target out there. I mean, we don't have to wonder, you know, is the person really channeling your dead child, etc. Because it's a known target. You know, it's a known training target of, you know, 14,000, 15,000 training targets that the military developed. And so every single time you go through the process, at the end, you can actually see what the target is. And then you can compare, you know, how you did. And it's not just a matter of sitting there and sort of spontaneously creating an image in your mind. You know, like my friend, I was telling him that I could do this controlled remote viewing. He says, "Okay, well, fine, just tell me what's in my hand right now." See, he's expecting me to use my mind to reach out and see what that is. No, that's not what it is.
It doesn't work that way.
Well, but for a really beautiful reason, George, what we were talking about before. Remember you were talking to me about the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's what we learned from controlled remote viewing. All the information in the universe is presenting to us at all times. So, for example, let's take the remote viewers like to use the example of the Eiffel Tower, so that nobody will ever use that as a target. So the information having to do with the Eiffel Tower, that's part of all the universe information in the universe. Well, the information having to do with the Eiffel Tower is that it's hard and it's metallic and it has these long, you know, these long little wires, you know, and all that sensory information.
Right.
So what you do with controlled remote viewing is you basically are given a target number that has to do with the Eiffel Tower, and you just let the information stream into your mind. And that's part of the protocol then, is understanding how to sort out what is the information coming from the Eiffel Tower And what is analytic noise? You know, you suddenly get, oh, I think it's the Empire State Building. Well, so, you know, so that is put in a different category, a different, you know, that's what I mean by the sorting of mental imagery. And then you get a burst of other images. You get, you know, tall, you know, skinny, strong, wiry, you know, and you put that in a separate little section. And as you go through this process, you know, eventually you're able to reconstruct the image of the Eiffel Tower just as you reconstruct any other visual image that you have. We were talking before about how, you know, let's say, you know, when you see an object, you see the computer on your desk. Well, you're not really, what you're not even seeing lines. You're really just seeing contrasts of colors and shades. And then your brain takes all that sensory input and creates the image of a computer. So, amazingly enough, controlled remote viewing is no different. We're just taking the sensory input from a different reality.
What is your opinion of remote viewers who look in the future, or at least they claim to? They see an asteroid coming, or a sunburst coming, or a war between Israel and Iran. What are they doing?
Here's the deal. So, how does all this work? These are what we call non-local perceptions. This is the link with near-death experiences. I got started with this because children, when they die, they say, hey, I could accurately describe this reality, but guess what? I floated out of my body, and I saw a man that I thought was Jesus, and he was really nice. And I saw a light that had a lot of good things in it, and it was real. So that's a non-local perception. It's not a hallucination. It's just they're seeing something else that isn't here. So, all right, and now we're talking about, like, you know, the Eiffel Tower across the other end of the earth. Right. Well, how does that happen? It happens because we're accessing this information from non-local reality. Okay, non-local reality is timeless and spaceless. So I'm going to get to you the answer because, I mean, the good news is then that all the information in the, you know, that exists is in this non-local reality. So just as we can access the Eiffel Tower from it, we can also access a dead child, you know, who, or somebody who lived hundreds of years ago, or we can access information from the future. But it's timeless, George.
It is timeless.
So how do they know? And the real psychics, people like Edgar Cayce, etc., you know, if you read the writings of Edgar Cayce, he says that. He says, I know this is going to happen, but I couldn't tell if it was going to be tomorrow or, you know, 1,000 years from now.
Exactly. But he knew it would happen. You're right.
They knew it would happen. But see, that's so to me, that's why. Okay. So what are, you know, let me just pause for a second. Let's say, well, okay, what are the non-local perceptions? Well, near-death experiences, okay, well documented, the best of the non-local perceptions that are documented in the medical literature. Okay. What other non-local perceptions? Past life memories, you know, mediumship, you know, premonitions of the future,
reincarnation,
angel encounters. You know, angel encounters, the same thing. You know, people, they, you know, very real. They seem to be in this reality, but they're actually the perception of something that, you know, that other people, you know, they're not part of our shared reality.
What about ghostly encounters, too?
Ghostly encounters, exactly the same.
Okay.
So these are all these types of non-local perceptions. They all have the same quality to them. They're timeless. They're spaceless. They, you know, they have that very vividly real quality to them. Of all these types of non-local perceptions, the only one that we can reliably authenticate is remote viewing. But I think, you know, now to answer your question directly, remote viewers who see the future, I think they have the same problem that, you know, psychics who see the future or anybody who tries to see the future is that they're then trying to, you know, they would call that analytic overlay. They're trying to put, you know, that's a left brain activity.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, time is only a function of us as a human brain. They're trying to take a left brain activity and say, aha, this is going to happen in the future. But the right brain, The right brain doesn't understand time. And this is, you know, there's always, everything in me always goes back to the near-death experience. A child said it to me the best. He said, I said, how long did your experience last? He said, well, it could have lasted a second, or it could have lasted my whole life.
He's right.
And it's, you know, once you start to understand the brain physiology of it, you understand that really what's happening to us as human beings is we have our left brain analytic functions that's constantly taking sensory information and creating our image of reality and, you know, making processes like time and cause effect and stuff like that. And yet we still have a constant stream of right brain information. Information that's timeless, that's the source of intuition, that's the source of our spiritual feelings, and it's something that's happening all the time. We don't really, you know, we don't have to, you know, and the only reason to take a time out is to try to reduce the left brain noise so that we can start to hear these right brain perceptions. but it's not like you don't have to turn them on. You know, you don't have to, you know, suddenly decide, aha, I think I'm going to meditate and tune into the universe. That's not the case. We're always tuned into the universe. It's just we're not hearing it. And I tell you, well, I'll just tell you real quick. Because I got to tell you what a child told me about it.
Sure.
He said, I once heard the sound of the whole universe rolled up in a ball of love and light. And it was a sound so loud, but even as loud as it was, that the unaware couldn't hear it. And the aware only think that they can.
I like that.
Spiritual perceptions are the faint ding.
Out of the mouths of babes, huh?
Yeah.
Do we make the mistake, Melvin, of pushing these remote viewers? A lot of them come on this program for dates. You know, they talk about, in episode, and we want to know when the earthquake's going to happen.
Right.
Is it going to be next week? Is it going to be? And so they come up with a date. And then when they're wrong, sometimes, we come back to them and go after them. Are we wrong by pushing them for a date?
Yes. And that's why, you know, well, yeah, because, see, all right, I got to tell you the whole secret.
And maybe they're wrong telling us a date.
They are. Because here's the deal. For me, it started with a near-death experience, and then a child saying to me, but how can this be real? Because if it's real, then you got to tell all the old people. So then I, you know, looked into it, and, you know, basically, you know, in the book I wrote, you know, Where God Lives, basically showed that our brains are connected to this non-local universe, this timeless, spaceless universe. But what you learn from something like controlled remote viewing is how we access that information, and we access it with our right brain. So the process of controlled remote viewing, you know, as taught by the military, usually has two people. One that does all the analytic function. The other person, they can't even really name what it is they're viewing. And when you see, you know, I remote viewed something the other day. I remote viewed, I had this, at the end of the process, it was, automobiles that were going round and round and round, and I drew structures and all this kind of stuff, and I was convinced that I was drawing a racetrack. And you know, that was, you know, my analysis of it.
Yeah.
Well, the monitor, my wife serves as my monitor, and she realized that it was actually within a big city, and I was actually doing Times Square, because but she has more information than me. So that's the same thing that you're doing to the remote viewer. You know, you're trying to, you would be saying to that remote viewer, man, you really blew it. You know, you thought it was a racetrack. But if you stepped back and you just looked at the basic sensory impressions that I provided you with, and the basic drawings that I created, and then you took the responsibility of taking those drawings and sensory impressions and putting them, you know, in the context of, you know, of whatever it was, well, then you yourself would realize, hey, wait a minute. He has accurately drawn something. He just doesn't know what it is. And you know, that's, you know, like, for example, from split brain research, we know that when the right brain is asked to draw, let's say, for example, a clock, it'll draw a circle, and then it'll draw this big pile of numbers. But it doesn't bother to put the numbers in the right place on the clock. It doesn't bother to put the hands on the clock. It just has them in a big pile. It knows that they're the pieces, but then it needs the left brain to assemble them. And so that, you know, that's what happens with these remote viewers that are working by themselves, and they're expected to, you know, to provide highly analytic answers. And that's not the way spirituality works. We, you know, I'm not interested in remote viewing so that I can see, you know, the Eiffel Tower. I could Google Maps and see it. I'm interested to learn the process of spirituality so that I can answer the question of my patients of how do they know if their own spiritual intuitions are real? How can they trust what is real when they see an angel? You know, and you know, think about it. If you've successfully remote viewed 20, 30, 50 times, then you start to learn, you know, what's a real angel and what isn't, because you've learned, you know, through trial and error and the protocol of, how to know what a non-local perception feels like.
What's going on over in Boulder, Colorado with a remote viewing club or a couple clubs?
Oh, man. Alrighty. So, you know, I'm a medical scientist. I have a mission of trying to understand spirituality through remote viewing, but now we're taking this sort of mind technology to a different sort of level, and we're trying to understand how we could remote view viruses. And remote view, right now we're doing a project in which we're trying to remote view viruses in tomato plants and try to reliably identify what tomato plant is actually infected and which one isn't. See, and, you know, I'm so glad you asked me that, because, see, that's a whole different twist than trying to say, well, tell me what's happening in the future and give me a date for this to happen or a date for that to happen. That's not something that's very practical. I'm interested in the practical aspects of spirituality. I'm interested in, because think about it, one of the biggest problems that we have today is we don't know when to stop treating AIDS patients because we don't know when they've cleared the virus. Well, if they're capable of doing the sorts of, you know, operational tasks that the military can do, remote viewers should be able to remote view viruses in the human body. And I can tell you right now that we have successfully remote viewed plants and have successfully identified what plants are infected and which ones aren't. And George, I've got to put in a shameless plug, this IRVA conference that's coming up in June 19th.
Okay, get out really quickly. Go ahead.
Okay, this is the most exciting conference on consciousness that's going to be happening today or a long time. These are the military remote viewers, and they're going to tell everybody how to use this information for civilian purposes.
They've got the information on your website, I trust?
Yes. They can go to my website, and our IRVAconference.org.
We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got Dr. Melvin Morris. We're talking about controlled remote viewing. Can this be taught? Some say it can. What do you think?
Absolutely. That's the whole purpose. The controlled remote viewing protocol can be taught to anybody. That's the beauty of it. It's a disciplined protocol that anybody, if they follow it, you'll be at a successful remote view. My wife and I don't teach remote viewing. We teach and talk about the protocol, because the protocol itself answers so many questions that people struggle with in terms of understanding spiritual experiences. We all want to know, you know, what is our own analytic overlay and what is true spiritual insight from, you know, this God, or how can we trust our own intuition, or such as that. And by the way, George, I want to just, you know, I just want to make sure I'm being really clear about something. I'm a physician. I'm a pediatrician in private practice,
yes,
and primarily a medical researcher. I'm interested in publishing, in mainstream medical journals. So, when we teach people controlled remote viewing, et cetera, first of all, we teach them the protocol, not how to view. And second of all, we don't charge for it or anything like that. We're interested in doing this as a research, as one of our research interests. So I want to make sure, I don't want to come across as, one of these, take my seminar and you can, you too can learn the secrets of the universe. No, anybody can learn to do this. And what I'm trying to do is to create a scientific and social climate that will understand, that we all have access to this kind of information. We'll be able to go from the wow to the how. And right now, George, we are totally stuck in the wow. We're like, oh, wow, this person spiritually healed themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And oh, wow, I know this spiritual healer, and someone went to his workshop and their cancer disappeared. Well, all right, we've heard those stories enough. Now we got to start doing the hard work of seeing how it actually works.
Are there people, when they're practicing remote viewing, in your opinion, are they also leaving their body like an astral projector?
Alrighty.
That's either a great question or you don't like it.
No. That's the question, George. Everybody's always said, okay, first of all, I got to tell you what a child told me about it. Okay. Because, think about the near-death experience again. Remember how, that child, she floated out of her body and she accurately described everything that happened around her. Well, that's what, remote viewing is about, is being able to, somehow access information, except the nice part about remote viewing is during the training you can see if it's really real. Okay, so, no, the reason I'm laughing is I love that question. So a child said to me, it was kind of like I floated out of my body, but it was kind of like I walked into my mind.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so, all right, so here's the Brazilian remote viewers, who, down in they call themselves the projectologists, which is sort of an unfortunate word in English, but they believe that they leave their physical body. And they're all scientists down there. They're doctors and engineers and such as that. And they believe they leave their physical bodies. By and large, the Defense Department remote viewers and their trainers, they believe that you're accessing information from a matrix, via a signal line. So they're sort of the in-the-body experience. Okay, I got to tell you this story now. Because I'm always of the in the body. I can't really get my head around an astral body. I don't know. I'm having enough time understanding how a dead brain can be conscious.
Function, sure.
come on. I went to Johns Hopkins. I mean, I can't get, okay. So we were talking about the Denver remote viewing group. And I remote viewed a object in the leader of the Denver remote viewers, in his home, and I successfully remote viewed it. Okay, so then he is going to remote view an object in my home, and we put an object on our table, and my daughter happens to be there, my 2-year-old daughter. And he's trying to remote view this object. So while my daughter, she's just sitting there, and suddenly she starts tracking across the room. She starts tracking, an unseen, object or being or something, and she watches it. We're just sitting there, and she's watching it move across the room, and then come and sit right at the table. And it's so dramatic that my daughter, she jumps down and she gets her little play tea set, and she puts her tea set on the table, and then she starts to offer, tea to whatever.
Sure.
This is. And this corresponded at the exact time that Mike Van Atta was was attempting to remote view this object in our house. So after that experience, I guess I have to tell you that, I think something probably leaves the body. But I'm more of the sort of thinking that, you know, this non-local reality encompasses everything. And so, there, you know, everything is in the body. But I have to tell you, the reason I'm laughing is because I had to rethink it. This just happened a few weeks ago, and it's kind of shooken me up. Because, I mean, there was no doubt about it. I mean, we took pictures of my daughter offering tea to, you know, and there's no way that, you know, there's no way that's coincidental. She's not just, you know, mysteriously offering tea, you know, to people that aren't there at the very moment someone's trying to remote view an object in our home. You know, so I'm thinking something must leave the body.
Yes.
You know, but that's the fundamental question. That's why I'd love to get the Brazilian remote viewers and the, you know, Defense Department remote viewers and really try to get these different groups with these different philosophies together and really try to study them and understand, is something leaving the body or are we just sort of accessing, you know, a great pool of information? Because, I mean, obviously that's got, you know, I mean, you get it, George. I mean, so remote viewing teaches us something fundamental about the human soul. That's the link.
Somewhere along the line in your work, I got to believe that whether you were spiritual or not in the beginning, you have got to have come up with some conclusions about how in the heck did this all happen? Who started it? How did it start? Why did it start? Or are you still knocking your head against the wall like I am?
I'm still knocking my head against the wall.
Yeah.
Because I just think there's too much to learn. I really feel strongly that, okay, you know, here's why this IRVA conference that's coming up in June is so important. And I have no stake in it or anything like that. I'm speaking at it. But here's why it's so important is that the Defense Department remote viewers about 25 years ago, they abandon this sort of, you know, haphazard, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, and they put it into a scientific and disciplined structure, and they actually learned how to do it in a useful and practical way. We haven't done that. You know, with near-death research has really only documented that it actually occurs. But, you know, I mean, all the alternative medicine and all the, you know, energy healing, et cetera, has not progressed any further than that. Then it's kind of like, oh, wow, it could really happen. We need to get disciplined. We need to take those same kind of techniques and start to systematically study, you know, how does Reiki healing actually work? What works? What doesn't work? You know, do you need the spirit guides just a bunch of baloney, or is there really something to it? And really, you know, have the courage and the guts to start asking and studying in a systematic way those kinds of questions. And we're doing that, George. You know, my research group is studying Reiki healers in a systematic way, and we're looking at how their effects on white cells, their effects on the immune system of the body, whether the Reiki healer can affect a random number generator or whether they can't, and we're publishing this stuff in the medical literatures, and we're getting invited to scientific conferences. And I think that that's got to be done first, and then maybe 20 or 30 years from now, we'll be able to answer the question that you're asking.
And it's all interconnected. I mean,
yeah.
The remote viewing, the out-of-body, everything, it's all hooked into the same thing.
Because once we understand that consciousness comes first, then we can start to answer some of these questions, I'm motivated because so many parents had children who died.
Yes.
And they want to know, well, what about that dream that I had about my son? Was that really my son? You know, what about, you know, I mean, 50% of parents who have a child who died, they have the impression of that child coming back and saying, "Don't cry, Mommy, I'm okay." But invariably, they have to go to a medium, they have to go to a psychic, they have to go to a workshop. And meanwhile, this child is at the foot of their bed every night saying, "But Mommy, I'm okay, stop crying, I'm in the light." And they say to themselves, "Well, that was just a crazy dream." You know, or and these spiritual experiences are so odd. They're so individual. You know, a mother once said to me that her son, when he died, said, the moon, I'm on a rocket ship to the moon." Well, if you just applied the conventional religion to that, you'd say, well, that was just some kind of crazy hallucination. So, you know, you're right. You know, it's all interconnected. Once we can understand, you know, what is real about when we're accessing information from non-local reality and what is what we're making up, you know, then we can start to understand something like, "I'm on a rocket ship to the moon." Sure, he's moving through a tunnel. He's moving, you know, in some sort of a, you know, linear way towards a bright light. And that's what remote viewing teaches us. It teaches us that there's some fundamental underpinnings that we can learn, and then there's all our analytic overlay, and that's what all these wars about religion are about, and that's why everybody's saying, well, you know, my heaven is different than your heaven, and not seeing the symbol, you know, that everybody is learning lessons of love about a bright light when we die.
Where does your work take you next? And I don't mean physically.
No, it's my work is entirely what I'm telling you is in the practical. I think that you know, that we've studied these experiences, and we're sort of at a dead end now. When people talk about what's up with near-death research, you know, I don't hear anything new. I don't hear anything exciting. What I hear exciting, like, you know, at that IRVA conference, is a bunch of military guys who now want to bring this information to the public. They know how to actually access information, so they're giving talks on things like shamanism, near-death experiences, and controlled remote viewing. And that's where I'm going next, is I want to understand, for example, Reiki healing. Reiki healing can be done at a distance. Reiki healing seems to access some sort of non-local energy. But Reiki healers today are just sort of doing it in a haphazard fashion, and they don't really know if they're doing anything or not. And they're using really subjective measures of, you know, like, does the patient feel better or do they have less pain? Instead of the types of parameters that we're studying, which is, you know, Reiki healing, raising patients' white counts, and then actually figuring out what is it that the Reiki healer does that raises a white count. That's entirely what I'm doing now. It's not as moving and touching as a child's story about a near-death experience or a mother's story about, you know, sharing a child's dying experience. But ultimately, in the long run, it's going to do a lot more in terms of telling that mother, yes, your experience was real. You know, so that they can stop writing me all these letters. And I've got boxes and boxes of letters from people asking me if their experience is real. Well, once we're able to show that people can successfully Reiki heal, or that energy healing is a real entity, and we can bring that into community hospitals, well, then they don't, you know, then their local doctor will say, "Hey, yeah, we've learned that we all have access to this sort of universal source of information. And some of us use it in healing, and other people use it to access spiritual information. And you probably did what remote viewers do when you had that wonderful experience of sharing your you know, what happened when your child died." And then they hear it from their local doctor or their local minister, and they stop. You know, when shows like yours no longer exist, George, that's where I'm going. I'm going, really, seriously. I mean, where, you know, where people don't, where there's no more paranormal. That's where I'm going. It's a lot of nitty gritty, tiny bricks to build a discipline, and other people got to start doing it too. We can't just keep telling these wonderful stories or just appealing to authority. This smart person said that, or this gifted psychic said this. You know, I want to hear that, you know, studies that show that ordinary individuals have psychic abilities and what that can tell them about their own intuition and how they can make their lives better with it.
Melvin, at no point have I heard you bring up anything to do with evil or demons or bad spirits as if it doesn't exist in the work you've done.
That's for sure. That's absolutely true. I mean, you know, children, you know, I mean, there's two lines of thinking about it. Maybe, you know, I know people argue, well, children don't, you know, see demons or, you know, children are too young or innocent for that. But don't you think that evil and demons, I mean, that's just, I don't know, those seem like they're constructs of the human mind.
Well, that's interesting that. Because I love the work you're doing, and I think it's great science, and it's great metaphysics as well. It's probably more science. But the fact that evil doesn't come up with these children, for example, you know, they don't say, I went through this level, and these things tried to grab me. They don't say that, which I find fascinating.
They don't even say that, George. I gotta really give you the impression of what they say. Is they go, wow, it was really weird. I thought I was out of my body, and they tell these little fragments of this powerful experience that usually have to do with colors and lights, and their experiences are odd. They'll go. Well, one of my favorites is this one girl. She saw her grandmother, and then she says, and then I was back. And I said, what do you mean you were back? And she goes, that's what I'm trying to figure out. So if that was an adult telling that experience, she would describe leaving her body. And I mean, adult near-death experiences go on for page after page after page. But when you get down to the raw child's near-death experience, usually their drawings are more eloquent than what they have to say. And then you learn from that, though, that I think that, you know, concepts like evil and demons or stuff like that, that's just stuff we make up out of our own mind, trying to understand what this spiritual light is.
That's fascinating. Next up, we'll take phone calls with Dr. Melvin Morris. So your stories, that's next. How did you get involved in pediatrics, Melvin? How did you get pushed in that area?
Well, I always wanted to know how the human brain worked. So I initially wanted to be a neurosurgeon. And I was just, you know, I just was, you know, I love that idea. Yeah. Of being able to, you know, to reach into the human brain, and you know, to remove areas of the brain, and you know, and see what stops working, which is, you know, the way, let's face it, 50 years ago in the bad old days was how they learned how the brain did work. But neurosurgery is, you know, it's an extremely technical, demanding, and doesn't. It wasn't, you know, it just, you know, I love the philosophy of it, but you know, the technical aspects of it. I decided to go into pediatrics because I love that concept of the developing brain, and you know, learning how the brain goes from nothing to then, you know, the fully formed conscious adults that we are. Is it, you know, to me, that was a fascinating process.
I had a story earlier, a neurosurgeon in Australia. Listen to this one. A little kid, not wearing his bicycle helmet, crashes, bumps his head. He comes home and he tells his mother, I've got headaches. She's a nurse. She takes him to the hospital. The neurosurgeon on duty realizes the kid's bleeding from within, right? He's hemorrhaging. So he's in a small hospital in Australia. They don't have any equipment. He borrows from the maintenance guy a power drill, drills in the kid's head, gets the blood clot out, And then they take him to a children's hospital about an hour later. And the kid's okay. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, George, I've done that in the emergency room setting. And when we work for airlift, you know, when we fly into these remote areas. Not a power drill. We've used I'd be afraid to use a power drill, but we've used a hand drill.
How do you know how deep to go?
Yeah, or to avoid that whoops phenomena. That's why they have to, you know what I mean? Where, whoop.
Yeah. Yeah, don't whoop if you're working on me.
Yeah, you know? That's why, you know, so we sort of, you know, makeshift, you know, jury-rigged, you know, a sort of a whoops protector. But, I mean, that's why, you know, the real stuff has, you know, that kind of stuff built into it.
When you cut the skull and you take a piece out, can you put it back and does it grow back to the skull or not?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It does grow back.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the brain feels no pain. Is that wild or what?
I did not know that.
Yeah, we sense pain, but, you know, with our brains, but the brain itself, that's how all the old-time neurosurgeons, they would do stuff, like, they, you know, they'd remove the top of somebody's skull, and then they'd take these stainless steel probes, and they would probe one area of the brain, and the person would move their arm, and they'd probe another area of the brain, and, you know, they'd move their leg, and that's how they mapped out the brain in the bad old days.
Now, if you were drilling into the skull, you'd feel that, right?
Well, you're going to feel right. You're going to feel, you know, because scalp has
nerves.
Nerves. You know, but the brain tissue itself does not. So that's, you know, these neurosurgical patients are frequently awake during the procedure. That you know, they just use local anesthesia. Frankly, that's how we know a lot about these psychical phenomena, because when Wilder Penfield, you know, 50, 60 years ago, when he probed areas of the brain, patients would say things like, "Oh God, I'm leaving my body." Or they'd say, even they'd say things like, "I'm half in" or "I'm half out."
That is fascinating.
Yeah, so there's a lot of science to that. I was once on National Public Radio and I was debating one of these, you know, skeptical inquirer type of people, and he ended up calling Wilder Penfield a pseudoscientist because, you know, he just was unaware.
Pseudoscientist.
You know, that kind of research had been done. But they've been able to map out, you know, premonitions, and there's a whole area of the brain that's dedicated to having it. Well, George, why would we have a whole area of our brain dedicated to having psychical and out-of-body experiences unless these experiences were real? I mean, you wouldn't have a TV set in your house, you know, broadcasting information, you know, from an invisible, you know.
That's true.
You know, I mean, unless it, you know, it's not just sort of randomly creating a visual image, you know, you're getting some real information from it.
Good point. To the phones we go. We'll go east of the Rockies, Joe in Overland Park, Kansas. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Morris. I'm a big fan since 2004. Had a couple of things to say and one question. One thing I notice, I seem to be able to access when I'm falling asleep or just waking up what I call the kind of the palate of the mind, which is like a storm of information. And I'm not really awake. I'm still kind of asleep, and it's really interesting. But my question was, does being deeply in love affect the ability to access this information, kind of remote viewing, or could we call it like a co-location of consciousness, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, you know, real quick, because I want everybody to have a chance, but I got to comment on the first thing you said. What you're describing is called the hypnagogic state, the state between awake and asleep. And it's during that state that you can access non-local perception. And I'm just blown away that you can actually access the entire matrix.
Just about.
And the last person that told me this is actually a research scientist, and he's a plant biologist. He used to run his own, a plant biology company, and he was unaware that he was able to do this. And he's a skeptical scientist type, and it turns out he's one of the most gifted psychics that I've ever seen. He's able to bend spoons, and he remote viewed protozoa coming to this planet, and stuff like that. And he can do that same thing. And so now the second question, there's just tons of research showing that psychical abilities are enhanced fourfold by having a strong psychic bond with, you know, somebody that you love. That's why my wife and I remote view together.
Well, I would like to know more about that doctor. I've been taking notes on this for years. I journal, and when I wake up and it's still there, I'm scribbling notes. And I would like to be able to get a hold of you somehow. I don't know.
Wait, you can email me at spiritualscientific.com. But man, you're getting the raw data from the Matrix. I'd be writing all that stuff down.
You know,
people like Robert Louis Stevenson wrote you know, some of their greatest novels, and for people that are skeptical, George, I'm so sick of the skeptics. I can't tell you, but. I interviewed Jonas Salk about 12 years ago.
That must have been thrilling to do that.
Yeah, it was absolutely thrilling, especially the part where he casually says that aliens gave him the information for the Salk vaccine
what?
In the exact state that our caller was just talking about.
Oh, you've got to explain this one.
He states that when he was in that drowsy, half-awake, half-asleep state, that information flooded into him having to do with the Salk vaccine. And then it's his own analytic overlay that, you know, that he says it was aliens. I mean, just like when children have near-death experiences, one person says, you know, that it was, you know, their dog, and another person says it was their lamb, and another person says, you know, it was a man. And one girl said to me, she said it was a doctor, and he was 14 feet tall, and he had a light bulb in his body. You know, so everybody has a different description of what this thing is. But Jonas Salk said...
Amazing!
I was there with science writer Paul Perry. And, I mean, we're just like... I mean, just casually, oh, yeah.
You know, he was an incredible guy, too. When he developed this polio vaccine, he decided he did not want to patent it. And he said he had no desire to profit personally from the discovery.
Yeah,
you know what? They're not made that way anymore.
Yeah,
are they?
That's absolutely true about Jonas Salk. And it's just, you know, but remember, he had to take his spiritual insight to the laboratory. He had to take it, you know, and do the hard work of developing it. And that's the problem that I have with the metaphysical and spiritual movement today. Is that they're just content to say, wow, my teacher can make the rain come. And then if I say to them, well, how does he do it? They think I'm some skeptical guy saying he can't do it. They don't understand. I'm saying, wait a minute, I want to really know how he does it. Okay, let's break it apart. Let's figure it out. We're not going to make it disappear just because we study it. We're going to learn more about it. Anyway, caller, those are two great questions. You can email me at it's spiritualscientific.com.
Let's go to Palm Beach, Florida. First time caller. Go ahead, Dick. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I can't believe I'm talking to you, Judge. I listened to you for years and years.
Well, thanks.
I listened to a guy about a month ago by the name of Melvin Thomas Benedict. And this man had a near-death experience where he died and came back an hour and a half later. And I downloaded the information that he sent to about 8 pages. And I showed it to a friend of mine that's very, very into all this stuff. And he got on and analyzed every paragraph. And he said to me, I've done this. I know what's going on. The man is absolutely right on everything he said. But this guy Benedict had to die. My friend can do this. He's very psychic. He's a indigo child, if you know what that means. He's very up to date, and he can do this anytime he wants. But he says he's got to stop his breathing, and he's got to stop his heart. He's got to be very still, and he can project or do anything. And what he does now to help people is that if you have any kind of a disease or a problem, he takes your name that you're born with, your birthday, and he goes into this meditation where he has to be very, very still. His heart stops beating, and he can tune into the universe and pull up any information you want. He does this to me all the time. He tells me how my heart's doing, how many parasites. What he works on mainly is, he says, parasites is the biggest enemy, mankind. It kills more people than all the wars put together. There are 300 different types of parasites. They cause 130 diseases in our body. If you get rid of the parasites, you don't have this problem. And also, he says that you got to get rid of the mercury in your mouth. The dentists, they put mercury, they put root canals, they put wire in your mouth. All this destroys your immune system. He says the dentists are murdering people, and they're getting away with it, because any metal, any mercury, anything in your mouth destroys your immune system. You're only as strong as your immune system. But this man is just incredible that he can do that. He knows everything about it, anything. You can ask him any question you want, how the world began 85 billion years ago, all about the churches.
Religion. You've got to, Dick, you've got to get this guy on the program. I'd love to interview him for a little bit.
He's about 80 years old, but he's very, very talented.
Wait a minute. I got to interrupt you and just tell you something. Okay, 20% of your brain is dedicated towards your having the experience of total knowledge. When you die, when children die, they tell me, they say, everything that ever was and everything that was, it was in my brain. My brain exploded with the fireworks of knowledge. You have the ability to access information. And we have to learn how to stop looking to other people to tell us the secrets and mysteries of life and start using your own right temporal lobe to start understanding your own spiritual truths. We've got to move to that stage. We got to get out of this stage of these gifted spiritual people and realize that any of us are gifted as well.
That we can do the same thing.
Absolutely, George. I'm teaching engineers. I'm teaching, like I was telling you this, plant biologists, and they're doing it. It's just, the only objection I have, I think it's great to know that somebody can access any information for us. But then that puts it in the realm of something we can't do.
True.
And that doesn't move us towards a new paradigm of understanding we can all do this and we're all interconnected.
You were just mentioning you work with some plant biologists. What do you think of the studies and experiments of people like Clive Baxter where they pick up the actual stimulus of a plant when it senses fear and danger? Isn't that incredible?
Sure. That kind of research. Well, Clive Baxter is very, he's from the scientific mainstream.
Yes, he is.
So, I'm glad to hear what you said, because those same studies have been done in human beings, in which, Dean Radin down at the University of Las Vegas in Nevada, when he was there, he showed that college students could reliably anticipate seeing a horrible picture or seeing, a picture of a car crash. And he used the same technology that Clive Baxter used on plants. The same kind of, monitoring the physiology of their body and their heart rate, et cetera. Okay, why is this important? This is one of the tiny studies that I'm talking about, because those same college students, if you ask them, hey, is a horrible picture going to come? They say, I don't know. And yet their body does know. he's able to show they have changes in heart rate. Well, so that means, for example, my friend who was driving along Silicon Valley one day, and he suddenly had a feeling of dread, and his hands got clammy, and he suddenly felt himself slammed to the other side of the car just as a sniper's bullet came through the windshield of his car. We start to understand how scientifically that could happen. And there's a direct line of understanding from a scientific standpoint from Baxter's research on plants to Dean Radin's research to then understanding why people can avoid terrible events when they sense that feeling of dread.
All right, well done. Let's go to Wichita, Kansas. William, take it away.
Hi, George. You told me I should write a book, and I love your show. I don't know if you remember me, but...
I do.
How's it going? Well, you know, I have a real quick comment and a question for you guys. I remember calling a little while ago, about a month ago, telling you about my past life experience as when I was, as furthest memory I had, where I was in a white room, and there were two people dressed in Greek togas. Well, I had other ones like that of when I was small, and my parents can't remember, you know. No, we've never been to Africa, and I don't know what you're talking about, that that white room. So my question is really, how do you both feel about the transition stage and coming into this world versus your past life and this life, but the transition stage, that limbo sort of world in which we pass
okay.
through to.
Let's try to grab it, because we've only got a minute left before the break, Melvin.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's just the opposite of the near-death experience. People that have studied that transition phase, particularly in children, there's a woman in the Netherlands that's done this, and children who remember past lives, they describe coming down through that tunnel and then reattaching, re-entering into some sort of physical body. And they say it's just, you know, just another sort of circumstantial piece of evidence that the near-death experience is a real experience.
Absolutely. And that major website that you mentioned, spiritualscientific.com, correct?
Yeah.
People
yeah.
can get to you that way, send you emails. What about your works, the books, Where God Lives, Closer to the Light, Transformed by the Light?
George,
where do you get
I am
those?
So blessed that they're still in print.
Great.
Amazon.
Amazon's, you know, one of the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come right back. We're going to take final phone calls with Dr. Melvin Morse, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what's in store for tomorrow night at Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dr. Melvin Morris with us. We're going to take your calls. Melvin, tell us a little bit about this IRVA conference again.
Okay, this is a conference. IRVA, military remote viewers, these are the guys who really can do it. I mean, not the sort of haphazard, you know, spontaneous images that come to the mind, but that they can actually see a suitcase bomb in another city, and they can actually use their mind to disarm it. And lest that sounds surprising to people, how many people who are listening to this radio show have noticed the phenomena that when they're around a computer, suddenly it'll stop working or it'll short out or something like that? We've all seen that. When we studied children that had near-death experiences, over 50% of them as an adult had psychical effects on computer equipment. So it's not much of a stretch to realize that the military remote viewers can do this sort of thing. You know, they're just using their mind
right.
to interact with that sensitive, you know, they're not actually mechanically moving, you know, a piece, but they're interacting with that sensitive equipment. Okay, well, these guys, they have only been focused on this whole issue of, you know, their, you know, what they're doing in the military. And they're insulated from the rest of the world. They don't have the problems that I have. Nobody's laughing at them. They've got unlimited funds. They can spend all the time they want, you know, just perfecting this technology. Well, finally, they're reaching out and understanding the spiritual implications of this. So you have Roger Nelson of the Global Consciousness Project. You've got guys, you know, giving lectures on what mediums and, you know, and controlled remote viewers have in common. You have Russell Targ talking about his daughter, who was a great spiritual healer, and how you have to protect yourself spiritually when you're remote accessing another body and trying to heal something in it. I mean, you know, so for the first time, they're actually showing us how this kind of information can impact our lives. And this is not, you know, I went to a conference just over the weekend, some Hawaiian healer, you know, talking about energy healing and all this stuff. And it was a whole day of crap. I mean, I can say that, you know, I mean, it really was. It was just, you know, it was just a bunch of philosophy and people laying on the hands and then everybody talking about how it made them feel. Well, you know, come on, we can do better than that. We've got to do better than that. And for the first time that I'm aware of, they're actually saying, hey, we know how to really do it. And now we're going to let you people in the civilian world know. We're going to be presenting our research on how you can remote view a virus in a plant. And there's not much difference, you know, between remote viewing a virus in a plant and a human being. And then think of the practical implications of that. We're going to be presenting our research on the parallels between controlled remote viewing and near-death experiences. And it's an amazing opportunity. It's one of the most interesting conferences that will be around for years. This won't happen again, that's for sure.
Should be pretty good.
I'm amazed that it's happening at all.
West of the Rockies, Salem, Oregon. Go ahead, Don.
I was wondering about intuition. I don't know. I can see stuff coming a mile away. Friends, family, neighbors, the whole nine yards. And then people, you know, they don't go, well, how do you know that? But it happens.
Right.
And, you know, I don't understand how it happens, but, you know, you're the expert on this. And the other thing is everybody wish Tom to get feeling better, and I'll jump off and let somebody else on. Thanks, George.
Okay.
So intuition, just another non-local perception. Intuition is just that direct spiritual or, you know, insight from another reality. Hey, guess who has no trouble with intuition? It's people like policemen. We did a 20-year study of law enforcement officers, and they don't have this whole wow phenomenon about it. The typical law enforcement officer, when we ask them to describe an intuitive experience, will say something like, I floated out of my physical body, I looked down, and I saw that the suspect had a weapon hidden in the back of his trousers, and so I immediately acted to save my life.
That is,
you know, because know it's real because it's saving their life.
Something kicks in.
Yeah. So, but the rest of us are sitting there floundering. We don't trust our intuition because it's not that important to us. Well, it's our lives. It is important. And people's got to start learning to trust their intuition. And there's a, you know, there's no different. To me, that's just another, you know, it's all interconnected. You know, intuition, spiritual visions, near-death experiences, you know.
We should add deja vu to that, too.
Deja vu, absolutely. That's another non-local perception. That's, you know, that accessing that timeless reality. And then, of course, it seems odd to us because suddenly it's out of time after we've accessed the information.
Let's go to Hollywood, Florida now on the wild card line. Linnea, hi there. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yes, this is Linnea. I have a question that as soon as the show opened and the initial thing, one of the initial stories that you said, Melvin, was about the little girl that had...
she was under for 18 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
And she talked about the nurse's cat that died.
Yes.
I've always been fascinated about what happens to animals after they die. I mean, what did this little girl say about this cat?
Well, she didn't say anything about the cat. She just overheard a nurse talking about it. But we, you know, there's no doubt that animals have the same experience. I mean, we've heard this too much, and we've heard too many kinds of, you know, I really don't have time to go into it all. You know, my wife has a blog on the website Spiritual Scientific, and she talks a lot about animals and animal heaven in her blog, and I think I would just go to her blog. Her name's Pauline.
Of everything that you've studied with regards to this near-death experiences with children, what has fascinated you the most, Melvin?
What fascinates me the most is that this information is available to all of us at all times, and we seem to totally overlook it. that we don't have to wait until we die to have this experience of interacting with spiritual realities and a God, for lack of a better word, that, you know, I don't really believe in, I guess. But, you know, it's just we can access this information in our ordinary lives by paying attention. So it fascinates to me how easy it is. And I had a good friend, his name is Pierre Jovanovich, and he was the one that dodged a sniper bullet I was telling you about before.
Yeah.
And he said that for people who don't believe in angels, spend 30 days carefully documenting everything that's happening in your ordinary life, and you will see an angel. And I don't know of too many people that have taken that challenge and haven't seen an angel. Certainly I can tell you I have. What people call an angel, whatever that is. But you have to pay attention. And so, you know, I'm not fascinated that this stuff is miraculous and wow. I'm fascinated how ordinary and mundane it is. The miraculous is mundane. It's ordinary.
I haven't seen an angel, Melvin, but I'm sure I've been helped by them a number of times.
Have you spent 30 days really paying attention?
No. Absolutely not.
I mean, you know, see, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to understand these spiritual realities. And when you think about it, the lesson we learn from children who have near-death experiences is that we're supposed to be learning lessons of love during this life. So in other words, we're supposed to be having problems with ex-wives and getting angry at people and all this kind of stuff. That it's in those kinds of struggles that we learn the lessons of love that we need to know as human beings. And intuition is just one form of understanding reality. We need analysis. We need, because you can't learn if you don't have analysis. But then we also have to understand we can all access, you know, what they call intuition. Hey, we taught remote viewing to this engineering. She was a woman engineer, and at the end of it, she said, "You guys have just validated my entire career," because she had always been laughed at and trivialized for having intuition. And so then she became excessively and overly, you know, she wanted to be more analytic than everybody else. And then suddenly she understood there has to be a balance. And, to me, controlled remote viewing is the practical aspect of the near-death experience. It's the practical side of it.
Okay, let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. Hello, Michael. Take it away.
Hello. I'll make this quick because I just joined podcast today, and it is fantastic. You should get
everybody
to do it. It is amazing. Thank you. This is a great show. Before I say this, Dr. Morris, I'm not trying to contradict you at all. I love what you're doing, and I love your outlook in this.
Contradict me. I want to be contradicted.
Well,
that's the only way we're going to learn.
Okay, I'm glad you – I'm not contradicting. This is another step. When George asked you about if you any of the children experienced hell or experienced demons or whatever, and you said it's never happened, well, we wouldn't
in my
it
experience.
To happen because yeah. The Bible's pretty clear that if a child dies, they're going to go to heaven. They're not going to go to hell. That's not even an option. So that they haven't experienced it doesn't eradicate that possibility. There's another doctor. He's a Christian doctor, Dr. Maurice Rawlings, who
yes.
did research on it. I'm not familiar with it. He did.
I know Maurice Rawlings for years.
Cool.
He's very. I agree. Yeah.
Talk with him. He did the hell and back, and what he found out is that many adults do have that experience and do experience a hell.
Okay. Now. Sure. Maurice Rawlings is, to me, the premier researcher, a super cardiologist. But you got to remember that he did his research in Tennessee in the heart of the Bible Belt. So all of his patients are kind of predisposed to actually to believe in a hell. So, but my mind is open to what you're saying, because if people will read Maurice's book, he did not believe in hell himself. In fact, he had a patient that had a near-death experience who was dying on the table, and his nurses told him, they said, "You got to pray for this guy." And he said, "Well, I don't believe in God." And they said, "Well, just make up a prayer." And Maurice describes how that made-up prayer boomeranged and made him believe in a God. And I agree with you. His work is very excellent, and it does definitely document a hell. But I'm just adding the caveat that he, you know, studied people who actually do believe, you know. So it still is an open question. How much is it our belief, and how much is it is really happening?
Melvin, there's something very special about the children. Do you think that they are given a gift?
Absolutely. They see with perfect, because they don't have a filter on it. I understand what the caller is saying, and maybe I'm open to the, you know, I mean, we don't know, you know, we have so many filters as adults, we just don't know. But when we studied children, we studied a total of 26 children who survived 20 cardiac arrest, and 25 of them remembered their near-death experience and described it in detail. When you look at the adult literature, only about 7 to 10% of adults remember their near-death experience. And I believe that's because they have so many filters and so many belief systems that, you know, they've screened out the most experience, you know, important experience of their lives. Whereas children just have that simple honesty. They just tell you, wow, I was floating out of my body and I saw the sun. And it had a lot of good things in it for me. You know, just like that.
Okay, Manhattan we go. New York, Andrew, it's good to have you with us.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks.
Good.
My question is actually, you've been talking about the left and the right brain. My question is actually with the center of the brain, with the pineal gland. I've heard that near-death experiences and actually during dreaming that this gland will... basically a chemical, a DMT will release this chemical that actually perpetuates you into dreaming or an experience.
I think so. You're right. And it also releases melatonin, doesn't it, Melvin?
Absolutely. But I think that, you know, this is left over from you know, from older physiological and neurophysiological thinking. When I talk with the scientists down in Brazil, where, you know, I think the cutting edge of consciousness research is happening, they don't really feel that the pineal gland is all that involved anymore. You know, that's, you know, left over from a couple of hundred years ago. And we've got to just keep updating. We got to keep understanding. We got to keep willing to, you know, to discard what may not be appropriate anymore. And I don't think that the pineal gland is all that involved in spiritual events as we once thought, perhaps 50 years ago.
I know people are taking melatonin supplements, though, and some of them report very bizarre dreams.
No kidding. That's interesting. Because,
yeah.
I mean, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends melatonin for, you know, to help even, you know, even 5-year-olds fall asleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I think that would be very interesting to understand, you know, that goes back to an earlier caller's comment on, you know, that sort of, you know, what happens when we sleep. Lucid dreams, the hypnagogic state, seems to also access this non-local reality.
Okay, we'll go to Duncan, South Carolina, east of the Rockies. It's James. Hey, James.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Mel.
Hi.
I had a near-death experience in a car accident. I should have died, and I walked away with a bump on my head. And ever since then, I've been having these dreams that come true. Would that be remote viewing or precognition?
Yeah. And a very, very, you know, that's a well-documented phenomena. You know, and of course, you know, why not?
Sometimes that happens. A bump on the head does something very strange to you, doesn't it?
I have no doubt that if we imaged your brain, we would find increased electrical activity in the right temporal lobe. I've studied probably 20 patients who have what they call right temporal lobe seizures or increased activity, electrical activity in the right temporal lobe, and they have verifiable dreams that come true. We have them keep journals, you know, for week after week after week, so we don't have that, you know, that effect, you know, where you discard the stuff that you don't remember, and when it does come true, then you say, aha. No, we had patients basically kept the journals for a year, and we showed that patients with right temporal lobe seizures or events, in fact, had dreams that came true.
What was that case of that woman where she had literally half a brain in her head?
Yeah.
And she still functioned.
Oh, absolutely. When I was a medical student, I worked with the great Dr. Mountcastle, who removed half of people's brains. And that, you know, that's one of the dramatic proofs of this top-down causation. And top-down causation meaning that the mind comes first and then expresses itself in a brain to perceive this reality. Think about it. When I was a medical student at Johns Hopkins, I took care of many patients that half of their brain was removed, and yet they had very, very little effect from it.
This whole evening.
Because the mind just created other neural networks in order to function.
This has been fascinating. Melvin, thank you so much. Appreciate you being on the program. It's been 5 years. We got to keep that a little closer next time. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.